take part in the Christmas card stream. Now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
Understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. I'm now here with Hector Drummond, an English writer and Twitterer. Some of you might have seen his stuff on X. Hector, welcome to Millennial.
Thank you, Oz. Thank you for having me on the show.
Excellent. Could you introduce yourself briefly to the audience just so that people know what kind of background you come from and what you do?
My background is, I suppose, mainly I was an academic for quite a long time. These days, I'm mainly a writer. I used to have a live stream myself a few years ago with a guy called Simon Roberts, who some of your listeners might know. That's a few years since you've done that now, so I'm a bit out of practice now. Hopefully, I'll be getting back into it. Next year, I'm looking to be doing loads and loads of videos and things. I'm going to be getting back into it. So I suppose this is kind of my sort of reintroduction to that scene tonight. People can find me on Twitter at Hector_Drummond. My YouTube, I haven't been banned from YouTube because I've only ever had one video up there. I may get banned at some stage later on, but for the moment, it's Hector Drummond. Videos, and hopefully I'll be putting some stuff up there early next year.
Right, okay. And what kind of topics do you cover?
I'm actually going to cover pretty much everything: history, culture, science, and music. But mostly from a kind of right-wing perspective, far right, whatever, dissident right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see us as far right, but whatever. That's what we're called. Yeah, yes, exactly. I just see myself as reasonable. I just want a sane life back, a sane world. That's all. Okay, so what we're going to talk about is the issue of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, and the problem of fake, phony conservatism. So why don't you take us away with what do most people think of when they think of conservative? What do they expect from a conservative party, a conservative government? Let's start with that.
What do they expect? Well, I guess they expect everything that conservative governments don't do. They expect law and order for a start. Obviously, we don't get law and order from any kind of conservative government. They expect sound finances. And, well, we kind of used to get that, I suppose, from conservative governments. We certainly didn't get that from 2010 to 2024. Sensible policies on immigration and net zero. I guess they're four of the biggest topics. They're things that no conservative government can possibly offer now.
And also some sort of attachment to traditionalism. I think that's a thing in ordinary conservative voters, and they hope that the Conservative Party will deliver that, will restore things and restore some sort of traditional mores in society. But that never happens. Never happen.
I think people have given up on, I think even conservative voters have given up on that. Nobody believes that anymore. A Conservative government is going to give you that.
Yeah, I think that probably ended with when Cameron brought in gay marriage. You can't really, from that point on, it's not conservatism you need, but something radical. Because if that's where the Conservative Party is, then it's not going to restore anything. And what would you say is the path, like, to go to from specifically to Big C, the Conservative Party, the Tory Party? At what point did it lose its direction, in your estimation?
Well, I think it's probably always been compromised and owned by people who are not on our side, really, going back a long, long way, going back to the 50s and 60s and 70s. I don't really think it's ever been on our side. And a lot of people say, well, but Thatcher was different at least. But, I mean, a lot of people on the right have noticed recently, well, Thatcher in many ways wasn't really our friend either. You know, she was too liberal. She let in a lot of the wrong things. So I'm not really sure that conservatism was ever, or the Conservative Party was ever really on our side. But I suppose since Cameron came in, it got noticeably worse. You can definitely say that. There was less of a pretense then, and they started saying things like, well, we're the heirs to Blair, we're basically continuation of New Labour. They kind of gave up the pretense at that point.
And Theresa May was
also like that as well. Although she didn't get on with Cameron and Osborne, she was no better than them, and she went around saying things like, the Conservatives are the nasty party and so on, so you were never going to get anything small c conservative out of her.
Yeah, of course. Thatcher's an interesting one because I think she wanted a conservative Britain that she remembered from childhood. I think she probably had an attachment, a fondness for that. But I don't think she realised that, first of all, the machinery around her was never going to allow her to bring that back. And second, I don't think she realised how much the country itself had changed since her childhood. And it just wasn't the same English people that she had in her mind. But, of course, the major problem with Thatcher was that she had this very one-eyed view of, everything's about economics and people being self-sufficient. And that just wasn't going to happen in the 80s, I don't think. I mean, there's a lot that could be said about that, but this is your interview, so...
I'm happy to talk a bit about that. Yeah. I think you're right about that. And I think she did want to go back in many ways to the old Britain. But the way she went about it was, to a large degree, a mistake. And to be fair to her, a lot of people on the right made that mistake as well. And probably 20 years ago, I used to kind of think that was kind of right as well. Things like the free market, the free market would save us, that kind of view. And she thought that if you gave power back to the markets, and she thought that would give power back to the people, and that would restore the old Britain. I think she genuinely thought that. But unfortunately, as we know, that didn't work.
Yeah. Could you go into that in more detail so that people understand your perspective on what has gone wrong with conservatism there? Because, as you say, she wanted this, but the way she went about it was misguided. Could you go into that?
Well, I think we've sort of discovered in recent years that the free market isn't really our friend. The free market has a lot of virtues. Supply, and by free market, I mean things like not a totally free market, but the sort of supply side reforms that she had in mind. It would allow people to express their views by patronising companies they believed in, companies that shared their values and so on. But that doesn't happen because there isn't really a free market. There isn't really the opportunity that people can just pick and choose who they deal with in the modern world. So I think that was one problem. Another problem was that the free market it dissolves social bonds. That's the big problem with it. And it introduces global capital as well, and it brings in power brokers who don't necessarily have the interests of the British people at heart. And they want things like immigration for cheap labour and so on. So we thought the free market was going to be good for us. But actually, all it did was dissolve a lot of the old bonds and traditions that held Britain together. I mean, arguably, they were disappearing anyway. I think that's probably true. But a lot of the reforms that she brought in hastened that end. So I guess that's the criticism we have. A lot of people on the right now have that criticism of Thatcher and of Reagan in America at the same time. You just transferred power away from the old traditions and the old bonds and move that power towards, I suppose, capitalistic actors who weren't really on our side or didn't care.
And for a long time, it was impossible to say this kind of thing in right-wing circles, conservative circles, because there was this hero worship of Thatcher that really lasted, I would say, into the 2010s among them, among conservative voters. And so there was always this assumption that, well, the problem, what New Labour did wrong was they moved away from that too much. They moved away from libertarianism and free market, and there's this overbearing state that they've built. Well, I mean, they have built an overbearing state, but I think that really misses the point that it was the whole direction in the first place that was wrongheaded. And as you say, Thatcher's government left Britain a much more atomized society than it had been at the start. I also think she just didn't do enough to help small.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people.
The upheaval.
I guess a lot of people still kind of worship her or did worship her in the 2010s because she's one of the few people from those years who actually stood up to the left and took them on and attacked them in public and so on. So she seemed like a brave person who was on our side, and she is to be commended for that. She did stand up against them, but that shouldn't blind you to thinking that all her decisions were good ones, because obviously they weren't. I suppose Peter Hitchens was the only one who ever sort of said this sort of thing in years past on the right. So that's where it's got to give some credit to Peter Hitchens there.
Yeah, I think also Roger Scruton, but to a lesser extent, because I think he, from memory, he did have a sort of, I think he did like Thatcher. But that's a great example, actually, of what we're going to be talking about, where someone who is conservative-minded ends up being bamboozled or tricked by someone by a system that is not conservative at all. So none of the things that Roger Scruton valued about England were preserved by the various conservative governments that he saw in his lifetime. And yet he remained a conservative. A similar person is David Starkey, who remains a member of the Conservative Party. I know people will say, well, he's gay, what do you expect? But that's not a good enough answer. I mean, he should be able to see beyond that. But anyway, let's get to the main thing. The Conservative Party is discredited in the eye since Cameron 2010, but especially over the last 5 years that it was in power, so 2019 to 2024. Let's go into that and explain in detail how the Conservative Party really discredits itself with its own voters.
I suppose the first thing to look at is the fact that Boris Johnson got into power with a big majority on the promise of being more of a proper red meat type conservative party. He was, even if he didn't say this explicitly, there was an implicit promise there that we're going to throw away all that Theresa May stuff and the David Cameron having to rule with the Lib Dems and so on. We're going to be a proper right-wing government here. So first of all, they set themselves up as that. So there was a long way to fall if they didn't live up to that. And of course, they didn't live up to that remotely. They didn't do anything remotely conservative. And I suppose the obvious point is that they let in millions of foreigners. So, it's no great mystery. I think the only mystery is, why do they still have like upwards of 20% in the polls? I mean, who on earth is still going to vote for the Conservatives? I've often wondered about this. I mean, some polls, they're down around 15, 16%, but it's usually between that and 20. And you think, who is voting for them? I think maybe it's just older people who are so stuck in the old paradigms. Also, I think possibly a lot of the foreigners who are not left-wing, maybe a lot of Indians who are not stupid enough to vote for Labour, but they're maybe a bit wary about reform. I mean, reform does have significant Indian support, but there's probably a lot of Indians in Britain who are like, well, I'm not sure about reform. They might want to kick me out. So maybe a lot of them are still voting for the Conservatives, because otherwise it's hard to work out, God, why would anyone still stick with the Conservatives? I mean, why do you think people are sticking with the Conservatives?
I've no idea. I think that there's a tremendous lack of imagination in the average Conservative voter, the sort of Conservative-minded person. And so they just imagine that, well, any other option would be a wild, radical departure, so I've got to stick with the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and you'd think that maybe as the election comes into view, people will switch more to reform. Those people would switch to reform. That makes more sense. But I suspect actually the opposite might happen, that you might actually get some people trickling away from reform and back to the Conservatives, because it's the devil, you know. And that seemed to happen in the last election last year, where reform actually underperformed in the polls and the Tories slightly overperformed. And some people said, oh, it's because people like Peter Hitchens were slagging reform off. That may have made some difference. I'm not sure it could have made that much difference. It probably is the people going back to the devil you know thing. Mind you, in 2029, that won't work so well for them, because they've got a lot less MPs now. So you might say, well, people are going to vote for their Conservative MP because they've had him or her for years and years. But actually, because they've got a lot less MPs, that argument's not going to work in a lot of seats, because a lot of people will have, you know, forgotten about their Conservative MP, and there'll be a different guy running for the Conservatives this time. So that's probably not going to work so well for them.
Well, they got decimated in the last election. They lost huge numbers of seats. I can't remember the numbers now, but it was really a ritual humiliation, because the sense of betrayal was massive. And this I find quite heartening, because it suggests that Conservative voters are less bovine than you might think.
And yes, although there's still this rump who still are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's always that percentage. But so that gets us to reform. What would you say about Nigel Farage prior to all of this? You know, because he became a figure really from the early 2000s onwards. And you know, Brexit was obviously a big deal. What would you say about him prior to the last few years?
Prior to Brexit, I suppose I didn't really have that clear a picture of him. I would have said, I'm not entirely sure, you know, I've got the general picture that people got from the media, that he was a bit of a radical anti-EU firebrand, and you'd see clips of him in Brussels sort of making fun of the Eurocrats and so on. So I guess I kind of had a hazy view of him being a bit of an anti-establishment rebel, I guess.
And to what extent do you think that was accurate?
Not, I don't think it was very accurate at all, actually. I think it was all a bit of an act, really.
Go on.
And I think, well, I suppose this is what we want to get into. I mean, I think Farage is basically a spiv and a con man. I think he's putting one over on us. I think basically he just wants to be in with the establishment, live his nice life, get a lot of attention, make money. I think he hasn't. I don't think he's been put into the position by the establishment deliberately. I don't think. I mean, some people wonder if he's like, is he working for intelligence or whatever? I think probably he isn't. But I think there was a vacancy there. The system created a vacancy for someone like Farage, who had the ability to appeal to the average person as an anti-establishment rebel, someone who's very anti-immigration and so on, but who never actually says anything actually radical in his words. They want someone who can create the impression of being that sort of person, so voters would flock to them, but wasn't actually going to do anything. How do they know they weren't going to do anything? Well, if you actually look at what Farage says in his speeches and so on, and the stuff he produces in print, there's actually nothing radical there whatsoever. So I think that's why the establishment latched onto him, knowing this is our containment guy. We'd rather not have reform win. We'd rather have Labour and the Tories win. But if things get out of hand and the third anti-immigration party, anti-net zero party springs up, we've got to make sure it's run by our guy. Not our guy in the sense of, you know, he's on the payroll or anything, but a guy we know who isn't going to really actually rock the boat. And you can see with Farage, as I said, you look at what he says, he doesn't actually want to rock the boat too much. He says things that his manner suggests it, but what he actually says, there's nothing there that tells you that he is actually going to change much. So that's why I think they promoted him. That's why they put him on TV loads. That's why they made him the face of the opposition and said, this is the big bad boogeyman who you mustn't vote for. Oh, he's so anti-immigration. Don't vote for him. So, of course, people have gone, oh, yeah, he sounds, or the people who think that way have gone, well, he sounds like my guy. Yeah, I'll vote for him. And they've shut out anyone else who could be a potential rival to Farage.
And of course, he always boasts that he pretty much single-handedly killed off the BNP.
That's right. Yeah.
I think he himself, the people that you're referring to will like that he, they'll help him to do this, but he wants to do it himself. I think he actually has a certain pride in killing off things that are more right-wing than him, or more nativist than him, or more anti-immigration than him. I think he sees it, I don't know whether it's some sort of social duty that he feels he has, or just that he despises, you know, angry nativism. Can't remember if that was his phrase or not. But for whatever reason, he does seem to have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo to a great extent.
Yes, I think that's probably a good insight, that he does actually want to do that himself. Not just so that he gets the credit for it, but perhaps he really does feel like that would be a worthwhile achievement. And I think probably he actually rates that achievement more highly than actually stopping immigration. Because you look at what he says, he speaks with a lot of pride about doing that. But when it comes to immigration, obviously we've all seen the videos where he's frightened to actually even say he's anti-immigration at all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he also infamously said that you can't lose Islam because then, well, if you, I've forgotten the wording, but basically, if you are anti-Islam, yeah, you'll lose the Islam.
If you antagonize the Muslims, we'll lose. He said, we'll lose with that tone of voice. We'll lose.
Yeah, yeah. So he's, and the other thing is that he said, this recent furore about his so-called racist schoolboy days when he was about 16, 17. I find this revealing as well, because he seems to take it very seriously. And I think that means that he really values respectability with the establishment, and he knows that this is something which could jeopardize that, and that's why his defense has been basically to say, well, that the BBC was similar back in those days, so they're hypocrites for pointing this out. But he's not saying, so what? He's not saying, yeah, I didn't hurt anyone, it was just banter, we've all done it. He didn't try to minimize it at all.
I think he's very worried about that. Yeah, it is, I think. He's very worried because he does not want to lose that position. And it was surprising that he got so worried because I think a lot of us thought when it happened, why did he just shrug it off and say, who cares? But no, he was terribly worried because he knew that to maintain this privileged position he has, he cannot be seen to be in any way racist, in any way anti-immigrant or anything like that. He's worried about. But I actually also, I mean, I also have another view though, which is sort of semi-tongue-in-cheek and semi-real, that actually what is going on is this is the establishment advertising for him. This is them marketing him, because I think they thought there was a danger that Farage was starting to seem a little weak, and a lot of people on the right, like us, were saying, oh, God, Farage is so weak. Why can't he say anything anti-immigrant? He's actually pathetic. He's just an agent of the regime and so on. And they thought, we don't want Farage to start fading away. We need to promote him again. So let's dig up or make up, whichever was true, these quotes from when he was young. And that'll make him seem like a lot more hardcore to those people out there who are got more hardcore views on immigration. That's going to rise Farage's stock with these people, because they're going to go, oh, yeah, you'd see what Nigel said as a schoolboy. He really is on our side. You know, I'm starting to have doubts about him, but he really is. He really is our guy after all. So I actually think in a way they were promoting him and putting him back to the sort of head of the anti-immigration crowd, but in a clever way, because he was still able to maintain that. Oh, I'm not like that. And he's going to commit even more strongly to it. Oh, no, I'm definitely not like that. I'll never do anything like that. But his reputation with the average person, or the average person who's against immigration, is raised. So it's a kind of perfect tactic. It sort of makes him important again on the anti-immigration side, but still forces him almost to deny even more strongly that he will ever actually do anything like that. So
to disavow that.
A clever thing they did. I mean, I don't know if they did this consciously. It may just be the way the system works.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think it's surprising and suspicious that this has never come out before. I find that very suspicious, because he's been high profile.
It has.
Oh, sorry, go on.
These accusations apparently were made quite a few years ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But they've been revived, and it's funny how they got revived now. So I also, maybe there's another thing at play. Maybe it is that some people in the establishment are thinking, well, we don't want Farage to get too big for his boots, because, you know, his lead has become massive. I mean, when I wrote the article on Substack that we were talking about before, that was about 11 months ago. And since then, reform taken a big lead. So possibly some people in the establishment were like, well, we better just give Farage a bit of a warning to say, look, matey, we've got a lot of dirt on you. Don't go thinking you're, you know, king shit or anything, because we can drag you down if we want to. And there's probably a lot more dirt that they have on him. So that's possibly another thing that's going on.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the main point, which is the propensity of Conservatives to fall for a character like Nigel Farage. What would you say are his traits that make him attractive, appealing to Conservatives?
First of all, he's very good in public. He's a very, very good public speaker. And, you know, he's been doing public speaking for years. He does regular, you know, radio shows and TV shows. So he's extremely experienced, and he's very, very good. I mean, he's probably the best person on the right when it comes to that sort of thing. So that's one thing. Secondly, he has an ability to seemingly speak his mind and be more honest and blunt than your average Conservative MP. I don't think he actually does really speak his mind. I actually think he talks in vague platitudes. But he's very good at creating the appearance that he's saying things that you can't say, because he has this kind of down-to-earth, blokey, let's go to the pub persona. I think that works very well for him. But it's but also his competition, the Conservative MPs, they're extremely stiff and overly formal, because, of course, being in the Conservative Party, they have to be extremely careful about what they say. So he does have that advantage as well. He doesn't have Conservative HQ breathing down his neck and saying, you can't talk like that, you've got to be much more careful. So I think that's an advantage. He can say things that the Conservatives can't, but I don't actually think he says very much. I think that's his real talent, to give the impression that he's on your side when actually he isn't. And also to give the impression, to make it clear to the establishment that, look, you don't really have to worry about me. I'm not really going to do that much. I think that is his great talent, to be able to signal to ordinary people that he's on your side, but also signal to the establishment that, look, you don't have anything to worry about here.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct, that he is. My only question is whether this has been manufactured deliberately, and the extent to which it has, because I think one possible theory here is those in charge of things, let's say, realize that the Labour Party's lost all credibility, and so has the Conservative Party. It's completely shot, and so we need a new dichotomy, a new Pinky and Perky, a new Pepsi and Coca-Cola, and so they're energizing the Green Party on the left, and they've put in Zach Polanski there, and he's getting a lot of exposure, far more than his predecessors in that role, which alone is suspicious. So it looks like they're energizing the Green Party on the left and energizing reform on the right, enabling reform on the right. And so that's going to become the new thing. And I imagine the plan is, if this is a plan, I imagine the plan is that it will be exactly the same as before. It will just be different labels and different names, but it will be just Tory versus Labour all over again. And that will maintain the facade and continue the programme. Do you think that's overly paranoid of?
No, I think that's exactly what's happened. The only question is to what extent Farage has willingly, to what extent has he been sort of a party to this? I don't think he's like an agent or anything. But definitely the system has operated that way. To a large extent, probably it's just operated that way just because it is the system. It is the liberal system, cannot allow anything outside liberalism to come in. So naturally it adapts itself when threatened, when Conservative and Labour start fading and failing, then just naturally it will form new parties which will take their place. But also I think there are probably people behind the scenes who are doing this deliberately. They've seen that. They've seen the way things are going. They've thought, oh, those old parties are going to die. We need some new ones. So I think probably there are people doing it deliberately as well. To what extent it's the first thing, to what extent the second thing, hard to know really. But I'm pretty sure both of those things are happening. To what extent Farage knows, I think he's probably got a good idea. I don't think he's on the payroll, but I think he's got a pretty good idea of how things operate.
Yeah, I would agree. So would you guess that that Reform are going to win the next general election, whenever that is?
Well, if it's 2029, that's a long way away, and there are a lot of things that could happen in between then and now, because these are not normal times. Certainly they look like they're going to win at the moment. There are some people who say, I mean, I know Pete North's been saying, well, Reform may fade and people will fear might go back to the Conservatives. Then that probably will happen to some degree. I'm not sure it's going to happen enough, because I think the Conservatives pretty much are finished. Mind you, if the Conservatives get rid of Kemi and bring in Jenrick, then things could really change. I mean, Kemi is dragging them down. They bring Jenrik in. It could revitalize them. I know all the Conserved MPs are useless and won't change anything. I know that. I'm not saying it will. But it might energize them in the minds of the voters. That may happen.
Because the problem there is that Robert Jenrik is associated with the Boris wave.
That's true.
And I think he even had specific responsibility for the Afghan asylum debacle as well. I'm not sure about that, but at any rate, he's associated with that dreadful Conservative government, and that's all that reform would ever need to cite to discredit.
Yeah, and they've been doing that. I noticed about 6 months or so ago, whoever's running Zia Yusuf's Twitter account actually really picked up their game, or maybe they swapped him with someone else, because he actually started scoring some really strong hits against the Tories, pointing out things like this and really laying the boots in well. So, yeah, I think there's no doubt that reform actually, I mean, I don't regard reform as all that competent on most things, but they actually seem to become pretty good at that sort of thing, at attacking the Tories and knocking the stuffing out of them. And I think Labour's probably finished too. Because in a way, this is what puzzled me about the Conservatives' support, that it won't die away. In fact, Labour support's probably dying away quicker than the Conservatives. But I think there's always going to be a certain amount of people who are going to vote Labour. So you're going to get a split between the Greens and the Labour, between the Greens and Labour, which is not going to be good for the left, because it's going to be hard for them to form a party if the vote is split between them. Yeah, possibly they might have a chance if all the Labour vote dribbled away to the Greens, but I'm not sure that's going to happen, you know, because the Greens are completely fucking Fruit Loops. So there's sort of relatively sensible people in Labour who say, well, I'm not going to vote for the Greens. They're too mad for me.
Yes. Well, this is why I think it's safe for the establishment to energise the Green Party, because it's never going to win an election. Especially with Zach Polanski. I mean, he's just crazy. He's a nutcase.
It looks like reform, certainly in the box seat, you'd say, if you're a sporting fan.
Yeah. So with that in mind then, assuming reform are going to win the next election, what do you think we can realistically expect of a reform government and a Nigel Farage prime minister?
Does Farage even want to be prime minister? It's not really clear that he does. I mean, obviously, one part of him does want to be prime minister, but another part probably dreads the idea. I mean, what the hell is he going to do? He's just going to carry. I mean, he's going to inherit a total mess. I mean, just the finances are just a disaster. Britain, I had a look today, Britain's £2.9 trillion in debt, which is a total disaster. It's just going up at a rapid rate. The Tories at least used to keep a tighter rein on the finances, but they didn't. They just spent like crazy over the last, from 2010 to 2024. So the finances are in terrible shape, and Labour's even worse. So what the hell is he going to do? I mean, they were talking the last few days about, we're going to cut $5 billion off the civil service. Well, $5 billion a year, is it? $2.9 trillion in debt. You're spending hundreds of millions more per year, or the government is spending hundreds of billions a year more than they bring in. You're going to need more than $5 billion off the civil service to make any difference, and they probably won't even be able to achieve that anyway, because these things are always more difficult than you think. And they found this on their local councils. They talk big about slashing bills, and they weren't actually able to do it. So they're going to inherit a terrible, terrible financial situation. They've made a lot of silly promises about spending. How they're going to pay for that is going to be very difficult. So I wouldn't like to be in Farage's shoes. Well, I would like to be in Farage's shoes if I was PM, because I would like to take the radical action, but I don't think Farage wants to take the radical action. He's not going to do anything much on immigration. The one thing he may do is actually cut a lot of the net zero stuff. He may do that. I think genuinely they're not very keen on that. So, and maybe that'll give them a bit of a feel-good factor. You know, they get rid of the ban on ICE cars and so on, get rid of some of the green crap. And a lot of people will say, you know, hooray for Nige, hooray for reform. So that may give them a boost for a while. It may save a bit of money for a while, I suppose. So that's one possible optimistic scenario for them. But I think in general, they're going to be facing a very difficult situation. I don't think they have the wherewithal to tackle the more serious and difficult issues. I don't think they have the ability. I don't think they've got the backbone for it. I mean, we don't even know who their MPs are going to be. It's hard to imagine, though, that they're going to produce the talent required. But, you know, all that remains to be seen. Who knows what their MPs are going to be like. Maybe they'll come out with some amazing MPs, but I kind of doubt, seeing as they get rid of anyone who seems anyway decent.
And this is a problem in Farage. What he did to Rupert Lowe was absolutely disgusting and so obvious that I was really amazed at how obvious it was, you know, how transparent. It was just, it was awful, but it was incompetently done.
Yeah.
But it was also just ruthless, absolutely ruthless. Yeah. And so that says, I'm afraid that says an awful lot about him as a man, Nigel Farage, because, well, what it means is this is a guy who cannot stand to be outshone or even equaled on his platform. So everyone around him must be lesser than him and less important, less admired, less talented than him. And what that means is that his project, that any project he creates, is going to have very limited success. And people are seeing this now, that reform doesn't seem to be gathering a talent pool. It's siphoning conservatives from the Conservative Party, but it's not building up a talent pool of its own. And conservatives from the Conservative Party, we know that they're just a bunch of traitors anyway. So I find this quite amazing. This phenomenon of a leader who doesn't want his own thing to succeed for whatever reason.
Some people are saying, well, he might resign after he. Sorry if I'm talking over you. I can't always quite hear you with got my speaker turned down. But some people are saying, well, maybe Farage will resign after a year or two, because he doesn't want to face the difficult problems. Well, then who comes in? You've got to suspect he wants Zia Yusuf, or to use his full name, Mohammed Zia Yusuf. And then we could end up with, we voted for what we thought was an anti-immigration party, and we end up with a Muslim prime minister.
that's grim as hell.
Even if it's not Mo, it'll be like Tice or David Bull or someone like that.
And they are just a joke. I mean, Richard Tice is, he'll never outlive the interview where he said, well, I'll be dead then. Or whatever his wording was. It was just terrible, an absolutely terrible showing there. And David Bull, or I've forgotten his first name. I think it is David.
Yeah,
David Bull. He's just seen as a fruitcake and a weakling, which might be unfair, but you know, it seems to be what he is. So if it comes down to them and Zia Yusuf, I think reform would just die. It would just be dead.
This is the plan, though, that get reform into power, reform turn out to be a complete basket case and hopeless and mess everything up. And then the public says, oh, God, let's go back to the old people. Let's go back to the Tories or Labour or whatever.
Yeah. It could be that. But at the same time, I think that all of this, I mean, assuming this is what's going on, that there's and you know, whether reform get into power or not, they're not going to do anything radical. And it might well be that the plan is that they never get into power, as you say, and it just defaults to the old paradigm. If any of this is the idea, then I think it's very short-sighted, because I think this country's heading for disintegration, and something needs to be done about that. I mean,
yeah, I don't want to be as black-pilled as your last guest, because that was pretty frightening stuff. But yeah, there aren't really many good scenarios, are there, in the future?
Well, I don't want to be a miserabilist. I'm talking from the perspective of the establishment. They should be looking to do something semi-radical in order to maintain a hold. If they don't, then they're going to lose their hold, because everything's going to fall apart. And I don't think bad.
I think it's
necessarily for us, but it's bad for them.
Yeah, it is. But I think they're in a death spiral. I think they've become a suicide cult. And I've seen people over the last few years saying, well, actually, Labour, now they're in power again, they're actually going to do some sensible things, because it would be rational for them to do so. And I agree it would be rational for them to do things like, you know, cut immigration back for a few years and get a hold of the finances. But they are completely incapable of doing it. They've shown they cannot do that. They cannot cut immigration. Immigration is still enormously high. Government spending is still enormously high. The green crap, which is just strangling us all, is incredibly high. They've completely failed to deal with any of it. They will not deal with it. And that's because they're not rational. There's no point saying, well, they'll probably do some rational things to keep a hold on power. I think we're way past that. I think we're now in the death spiral of the Liberal establishment. And they don't really know what the hell they're doing. And I suppose I agree to some extent with your last guest, who was saying it's just chaos. There isn't really some regime evil figures rubbing their hands with glee planning all this. I mean, there's probably some of that going on, but a lot of it is just chaos from lots of scattered groups with some power, some similar stupid liberal or radical ideas, who just don't know what they're doing and just have got this blind religious faith that what they're doing is right. And it's just, we're heading towards the cliff, because there's all these lunatics who are trying to steer, and all they can do is steer to the cliff. So I don't think the Liberal establishment is going to save itself. I think we're past that stage.
That's I agree. It's an interesting prognosis. How long do you think it's got? If you had to guess, I mean,
I don't know.
I put the same question to my previous guest, and he asked 50 years, 10 years.
He was very forthright about his answer, wasn't he? But I don't think I can be as forthright as that. I could go on for years and years. There's two possibilities. We get a sudden crash, or we just get gradual enshittification, as some people call it, where there isn't any crash, just everything just gets worse and worse, and we just get more and more migrants. The services, the public services, the private services just get worse and worse. Everything gets filthier and grimier. You get less and less money. You get taxed more. Everything costs more. I mean, we're already in that, really, aren't we? Everything is costing more. We're all getting less money. Rents are enormously high. If you're a renter, you're not in a good situation. The government's spending too much money. So, we're kind of in the enshittification process already. The question is, will there be a crash as well? And I don't feel confident enough about that to really say. But I do think the Liberal establishment is on its last legs, and maybe they'll go on for 20 years just keeping things afloat, just sort of going, everything would just gradually deflate, maybe. But I don't really see them coming back. And I think certainly in 20 years, I think you're going to see a very different country, but which way it goes, we don't know. If migration keeps on going the way it is, we're going to be in terrible trouble, because the country is going to change through that. If everything getting worse gives us a chance to get into power, then we're going to bring about something very different as well. So I think within 20 years, things will be very different. But which way it's going to go, I don't have much hope in reform doing anything. You know, if they get into power in 2029 and they're just kind of shit and get shitter and shitter as we get to 2034, it's getting pretty late in the day. That's 9 years away, and probably nothing will be fixed in that 9 years. But, you know, things could happen. Like Rupert Lowe is a loose cannon. What if Rupert Lowe forms a party? Things could change. Another new party could come into being. So that's why I don't think it's guaranteed that reform are going to win. There are other possibilities. It's even possible that, as amazing as it sounds, Labour stay in power somehow. Or, God forbid, the Greens win. Everything's implied. Yeah. It's like it's very hard to predict the future.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that I would like Rupert Lowe to start a party, but I think that it right now probably isn't the time for him to do it. I think that in a year or so he should do it, because I think the impotence of all of these other parties is going to become ever more obvious, and I think people are going to be ready for something at that point.
Let reform grind down Labour and the Tories. Let them collapse. Don't get involved now. Come in later when they're really in a bad way. That's what I think they should do. So just let those traditional parties collapse more, and then come in when it's looking like reform is sort of going to clean the board with everyone, and then come in and say, well, we're now the opposition, at least on the right, we're the opposition.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I think that would be great. And in the meantime, I think that, because I want to end on an optimistic note, and I think that you would agree with me that Rupert Lowe seems serious. Whatever criticisms we might have about him not going far enough on this or that, he does seem like a serious man, and he seems like a good organizer, which is really the key difference between him and Farage. Farage is a great speaker, great one-man band, but he's a dreadful organizer. Remember that Brexit wasn't him. It was organized by Dominic Cummings. He was the head of the Leave campaign. It wasn't Nigel Farage. So I can see Rupert Lowe forming a cadre of competent people who could take over. I can't see, and actually turn the country around. I can't see Nigel Farage doing that. I think the key word with him is showman.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I think Lowe, he certainly comes across as more serious. And these are serious times. We don't really need a clown like Farage. We need someone serious like Lowe. And I think probably he is a better organizer than Farage. Anything he forms will be better organized than reform. But I kind of agree to some extent with Pete North, who reckons his view is that, well, actually Lowe isn't really doing anything very much at all. It's a lot of strongly worded tweets, but what is he actually doing in terms of, you know, setting out policies and getting a proper team together? So I'm not totally convinced on that, but I think he's vastly more promising than Farage. And as I said, this is the time for serious people, these serious politicians, because, you know, we're facing, I think this is the gravest crisis Western civilization has ever faced, because we're looking at the end of ourselves. And we've had some big crises in the past, but nothing like this. And oh, yeah, he did say you want to be on an optimistic note. I suppose I shouldn't say things like that in that case. But I think it's true. I think we're facing the biggest.
No, it's fine to. Yeah, it's fine to outline what the stakes are. I don't dispute that at all. But I think that there is room for optimism. That's the key thing. But yeah, keep going with that.
Well, it's hard to sort of to pinpoint something that's going to change and save us. And, you know, maybe it'll be Rupert Lowe. But I suppose this might sound like it's clutching at straws, but I think things are shifting. underneath the tectonic plates, or whatever you want to call it. Things are shifting, and that's partly because public attitudes are changing. And I know elite theorists say, well, public attitudes don't change anything. And, well, I sort of agree they don't change anything very much directly, but they have subterranean effects, and they shift things around, and they also create counter-elites, if you think elite theory is a thing. Well, counter-elites get formed by general dissatisfaction. So I think the fact that people are changing their minds, that people are speaking out on social media, I know we don't have that much effect, but we have some effect. And I think, and also there is a general air of dissatisfaction in the country. You can just feel it everywhere you go, and probably across the West, most of the West as well. People are just very dissatisfied and angry. And I think that's going to get worse and worse. And that's just, that can cause things to crack and buckle. And then unexpected events occur that you didn't expect. So there's scope for, you know, black swan events to happen. There's scope for lots of things to happen. And if we got to keep pushing and hope that things will change, because things can change. I know people say, well, nothing ever changes. Well, things do change eventually. The world never stays the same in the long run. So I don't think the liberal establishment can hold. I think it will collapse at some stage. We don't know when or how exactly that's going to happen, but I think it will fall. So there is some scope for optimism there. I mean, it could be very messy and ugly. If the financial markets collapse, it could be bloody awful. But yeah, I do think things are going to change and something is going to arise. Which, yes, it may sound a bit vague, sorry about that. But yeah, I do think most likely there's going to be change coming about, but you can't really predict these things. Predicting the future with this sort of stuff is extremely hard.
Yeah, I think what you can say with certainty is that we're living in a time of great potential. And as you say, the tectonic plates are shifting. Something is happening. And the old certainties and the old institutions and the old systems, I don't think are able or even willing to contend with what's coming. And so, yeah, this is a time of potential. Okay, well, let's end on that. We can say about the conservatives, that because we started with that. Ironically, the conservative voters who just want the status quo and who just want things to be restored and all that, I think they're going to be the most shocked by all of this, the most unsettled by it. But I hope in the end they'll get some semblance of what they want.
Yeah, I'm not sure they will, but yeah.
All right. Okay then, well, Hector Drummond, this has been a good chat, so thank you for that. I'll be back in half an hour with Black Pilled, but in the meantime, Hector Drummond, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Okay, thanks for having me on, Wise. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.